Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 908 by my count. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois at the Reformed Forum headquarters, and I'm happy to be back for another episode. And we have with us today a friend and an exciting conversation partner, author, prolific author. We have Dr. Harrison Perkins, pastor of Oakland Hills Community Church, an OPC congregation just outside of Detroit, we'd say Metro Detroit area. He's also the author of several books, including Reformed Covenant Theology, A Systematic Introduction, and two more books that we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Harrison. It's good to see you. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you. Really excited to get to talk about these projects.
Yes, buddy. I've been meaning to get you on the program to talk about one of these books. First is Righteous by Design, which is subtitled Covenantal Merit and Adam's Original Integrity. It's in a series edited by J.V. Fesco and Matthew Barrett, the Reformed Exegetical and Doctrinal Studies series by Mentor. I've written a review of this that should be out soon. I thought it might be out in the current issue of New Horizons, which I just got in the mail a week ago. It wasn't, so I presume it might be in the next one. I turned it in about a month ago, so we're probably at a two-month lead time. We have another book also, Created for Communion with God, The Promise of Genesis 1 and 2, here as well by Lexham Press. So even before I could finally get around to scheduling you and asking you to get on the program, another book showed up. So that's all right. So we're going to be talking about both of these, since there is some thematic overlap, and we'll get into the story maybe of how both of these books came about, but I'm excited to talk today. But just in general, Harrison, how are things going over at Oakland Hills? How are things in your presbytery and maybe your ecclesiastical and academic neck of the woods since last time we talked?
Yeah, thankful to the Lord. He is kind and blesses. The church is doing well. We were just finishing up a new members class and received some professions of faith already, and have a few more that I hope we're going to be doing soon. And so that's a great blessing to see that happening. And we are free, as far as I know, from strife and conflict. And I know that that is a blessing that I don't take for granted, because a lot of congregations suffer in that respect. And so we're thankful in that regard. And academically, well, we just had Presbytery this past weekend.
And oh, you did?
Wow. Yeah, we did. And four men passed exams, and wow, we're really glad for that. It was a big Presbytery meeting. We had to take 2 days for this one, but it was good and exciting to see those guys come through. And some were licensure, but some were ordination, and one reception from the PCA, but all encouraging. And glad for those. And so that's good. And glad to see what the Lord is doing in Michigan and Ontario. And then academically, staying busy, and was just able to go and do a couple of lectures for the Student Association at Westminster, California. Thankful for that, and just trying to think about really applying Presbyterianism to churchmanship. And here in a couple of weeks, I get to go teach a class on covenant theology at Birmingham Seminary. So I'm staying busy, trying to be useful.
Absolutely. That's great. Yeah. We were talking even before we started recording today, just how I was hanging around and having some good fellowship and conversation with some of the folks down at Birmingham Theological Seminary. Ike Reeder is the president. Mm-hmm. We ran into each other before one of the sessions. We were both staying in the same hotel, as we were both down there for the Twin Lakes Fellowship just south of Jackson, Mississippi. So we got to talking and really excited about what's going on at Birmingham, and just comparing notes and talking about what we're doing here at Reform Forum, and co-laborers in many regards for theological education, doing different things, having different purposes, but still aligning on so many points. So hopefully we can keep talking with them. I went to a little seminary dinner that Ike hosted at a really nice little barbecue restaurant. So it was great to hear what's going on in the seminary. I'm glad you're involved there and doing some work. So you're a native Alabamian. What do you say? Alabamian?
Alabamian. Do you pronounce it? Yeah. So, and I was actually a member
to teach in the homeland.
That's right. Yeah. So I was a member at Briarwood when I was in college, and my original ordination was in the Evangel Presbytery there, even when I was overseas. I was ordained to labor out of bounds. And so until I took my present call, that was my personal and ecclesiastical home.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it'll be good to go back. And they are doing exciting things. Just the model of how they're able to deploy classes at various locations, and it's exciting, and I'm hoping to see it grow. I love to be
in. I don't want to hope I'm not letting the cat out of the bag, but I wasn't told not to mention anything, and he mentioned it at a dinner, so we'd love to have Ike on the live stream. Maybe we could talk more about their upcoming programs down the road, and so this episode should air toward the end of May. But there's some exciting things going on at Birmingham Theological Seminary, where they're introducing a THM program, as well as kind of taking their current Demon Honors program and converting it into a THD. So there's some opportunities for advanced degrees for people that are not able to move on site somewhere. And there are few and fewer opportunities in the States for research degrees of this type. So I'm excited at least for these opportunities and looking forward to maybe encouraging some people. We get asked questions all the time, like, well, what should I do? Where should I go? I'm looking to do a THM or a PhD. And there just aren't really good answers for people who either can't move or don't want to go into $100,000 of debt.
Yeah, so, indeed.
And it's just being realistic. So this might open a few more doors for people that could do projects that would really help the church. There's a lot of projects to be done. I mean, indeed. There's always more.
Yeah, I think, absolutely.
Especially at the THM level, that's just a good size for certain types of research projects, you know, write 100-page, maybe a little bit longer thing. There's all sorts of things that can be tackled at that size and scope, and would be really handy. The one downside to the THM I've always regretted is that it doesn't come with a title. So if we had some title we could give guys so that we could call them whatever, because they've earned their stripes at the THM, it's a really excellent and noble degree, but it doesn't, if you have a THM or an MDiv, there's no differentiation. So we need to come up with something. I think maybe the Dutch, they used to go by this Dr. Andus or something. And I don't know if there's some sort of American equivalent we can have, or we need to invent a title for the THM grads.
Yeah, we don't have a future participle in English that would help us out there. The will be doctor.
Yeah. Right. Or we need semi-doctor or something like that. I don't
know. There you go. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't get it. Whatever.
A little superscript. But
that shouldn't be the reason we do things.
A superscript.
Yeah. Something. We need something. Guys, you got to get their due. Yeah. Anyway, it's good. It's important and useful. And I would hope more people would do THMs, because I think that I'd like to read the projects. So I'm glad BTS is doing this. So we'll look forward to that more in the future. What class are you teaching? Did you mention, and I didn't pay attention? What are you going to be teaching there?
I don't know, but I'm going to be teaching covenant theology. And
oh, there you go.
Excited to get to do that. I think it's one of their core classes, and really excited to get to do that one. So it's the, I've taught on covenant theology, but it's the first time I'm getting to do a whole class focused on that I've gotten to design, you know, relatively speaking. And so I'm really looking forward to it and hope it will be helpful.
That's great. Now I'm looking forward to you doing that. Thankful that you have the opportunity. We have spoken about your book on covenant theology before, but now we're carrying this on to talk more about anthropology and eschatology and then how the two go together. Again, we have a really significant book here, Righteous by Design, Covenantal Merit and Adam's Original Integrity. This is an academic book. I mean, it's useful to the entire church. And of course, the subject matter and the lessons therein are important for every single person. This is readable. You've done a fine job, Harrison. I don't mean to say that it's a rough slog, but just by nature of the subject matter, it is an academic theological tome.
It's dense.
It's a little bit, it's dense in a sense, but I was a little bit surprised that I was asked to review it for New Horizons. I would have thought maybe Ordained Servant was the more natural outfit. But I do what I'm told. And so I'm happy to have written that. And again, take a look for my my favorable review forthcoming, but we'll touch on a lot of the points there, but also Created for Communion with God, as I mentioned, the promise of Genesis 1 and 2. Harrison, might you talk a bit about the origin of both of these the books? They're quite different, but they overlap. And I'm wondering, just obviously, as we're thinking about things and working on different projects, there are different spin-offs or different applications of topics. I'm just wondering about the history of both of these and how they started and how they both came to fruition.
Yeah, I think it really only dawned on me when we were, you know, emailing about doing both of these at the same time. And it kind of occurred to me, these were fermenting in my mind at roughly the same time in one way or another. And in some ways, they really are about the same thing. Just one is the sort of deep dive into the academic background and articulation of it. And one is the pastoral explanation. That's sort of by accident. But so the origin story of Righteous by Design is that when I was writing the earlier book on covenant theology, the kind of systematic exposition of the covenants, this is a kind of niche discussion to some degree within Reformed circles about the nature of grace and merit and the covenant of works. And I was trying not to make that overtake the discussion in Reformed Covenant Theology, the book Reformed Covenant Theology, and yet deal with it to some degree. And so I thought I'll do it in a footnote, you know, because you can just handle the medievals and all of that in a footnote. And that became a 300-word footnote and then a 3,000-word footnote. And then a friend advised me that they're never going to let you have a footnote that long. Turn it into an appendix. So I did. And then it ballooned even further. And then the publisher, Lexham, said, you can't have that appendix. Nobody's going to read that. And it was fair enough. So then at that point, I thought, well, I've got this material. I actually think that there is enough runway to turn this into a project of its own. And so pitched it to John Fesco and Matt Barrett for their series, and they were very kind to accept it. And so it really is pulling at a thread that has been in my mind since my doctoral work on James Usher in the Covenant of Works, and seeing how he was trying to push back against some Roman Catholic positions on anthropology, specifically around the donum super additum, the super added gift, which is this ontological elevation of human nature that serves various functions. But in regard to this discussion, it serves a role in, it is a God by grace adds this donum super additum, which enables merit. So to pull that together, grace enables merit in the Roman system as it revolves around the donum super additum. And, you know, both historically and theologically, I had had various questions surrounding that idea. And this was the opportunity just to pull hard on those threads and try to to tidy them up in my own mind. And it seemed like this was a growing topic in various discussions. And for good or for ill, I felt like it fell to me to take the first shot at a more elaborate articulation and addressing of both the historical concerns and how to reckon with it, you know, constructively as well. So that's the origin for that book. And then Created for Communion with God was really grew out of preaching through Genesis 1 and 2, but having these same ideas in mind as I was preaching and looking at how, I mean, God made us for communion with him and also made us with an inbuilt orientation towards an eschatological goal, you know, the new creation life. And that's sort of just hardwired into what it means to bear the image of God. And yet that that redemptive historical aspect is part and parcel of how we ought to think about Genesis 1 and 2. And so trying to bring, in some ways, put a focus. We get so caught up in certain questions and certain debates about Genesis 1 and 2.
Sure.
And wanting to put a focus on, you know, these chapters really are an address from God to his covenant people about our relationship with him. And that ties us into considering, well, what is that relationship like? And given sin, how are we to recover a good relationship and even reach our original destiny? So.
Yeah, that's really useful. I mean, both Genesis 1 through 2 obviously plays a central role in both of these books. Mm-hmm. And it's important, though, that we do understand the big picture. Like it does matter, and it is important that we talk about the days of creation, and there's a lot of important material there. But the biggest picture is who is man, and why did God create mankind in his image and likeness, and how is man to live in response to this? What is our role and our responsibility here? So there's a lot of anthropological, theological, anthropological material baked into Genesis 1-2, and I'm not so sure that people outside the Reformed tradition have really thought too much about it all the time. So it's really helpful here. You mentioned, you know, maybe as you were preaching through Genesis 1-2, that kind of led to some of the material for Created with Communion with God. As I'm reading this book, it's certainly something that could be useful for study groups, Bible studies. Was there any thought towards writing the material with that bent, or did it just kind of end up that way?
It kind of just ended up that way. I mean, as I was preaching those passages, and the first time that I was preaching Genesis 1 and 2 was actually in the summer of 2020 during COVID lockdown, and I was still in London at the time, and the idea of fellowship, you know, communion, was heavy on people's minds and hearts as we were separated, you know, we were distanced from one another. And so there was a real pastoral concern there. And as I was trying to address some of those needs from the pulpit, it just seemed like it was really well received. And that was actually the impetus for reworking it into something, you know, more widely available, is just actually the congregation's encouragement that this was some of the more helpful things they'd heard from me. And so they thought that it should be more useful.
Yeah, you describe Genesis 1-2 not only as emphasizing here this bigger picture of communion with God, and that's really an important shift in focus for modern readers, that we get that right, but you also describe Genesis 1-2 not as you say it's not a data dump or like a scientific manual of sorts, but it's you liken it to a love letter that's calling us into communion with God. How should that really shape the way that Christians read these chapters?
Well, you know, the conservative position, traditional position on the authorship of Genesis is that Moses, under the inspiration of the Spirit, wrote, you know, the whole Pentateuch, Genesis to Deuteronomy. And I hold to that position and still, you know, think that he was the human pen behind Genesis. And when we realize that, because I think one of the things that we can, you know, lose track of easily and understandably as we read this sweeping history of the universe and then of God's people, we can kind of think that the book version, you know, as we have it in the Bible, was kind of there being composed as these stories were happening. But, well, you know, Scripture tells us Moses wrote this, and that's, you know, reminds us that God gave even these original stories about the origins of creation and the universe as he was covenanting with Israel. In other words, you know, they are meant to be something, address a specific need that his covenant people had. And so it reminds us that this, yes, it tells the story of how things came into existence, and that's a historical story, and it's a true story, and it also has relational force, because he's telling this story not just to everyone in general, but to the people to whom he's binding himself. And when we realize that, we ought to see that, yes, the discussions about how long are these days, you know, what was going on there, those are important. But the most important is that the chapters are less about the creation and more about the creator.
Mm-hmm.
And that ought to be the thing that captivates our imagination and hearts more than figuring out the details of creation, even though I'm not saying don't do that. I'm just saying big bucket is God is speaking to his people and telling us why he made us. And that ought to be the thing that really grabs us.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also knowing about who God is, also he reveals himself through the things that have been made. And that struck me in the newer book, Created for Communion with God, how you emphasize the theme of beauty. There's an aesthetic aspect here that is emphasized, and rightly so. I'm wondering if you can help us to understand, you know, both the creation narrative and God's redemptive work through this lens of beauty, and why that's such a helpful way to think about these early chapters of the Bible.
Well, particularly chapter one unfolds, I think one of the things that strikes something that strikes a lot of people is how God is bringing order, you know, and things are he's refining the creation so that things work according to the patterns that we still know and the structures that that are still in place, and so he's fixing the universe to, you know, work according to the long-term plans that he has for it. But in addition to that, you know, it's not just basic order that comes about. There's also a lot of excessiveness. There's a lot to creation that God didn't have to do, even to make it work. You know, why do we have so many different shades of green in the world? Why did God make our eyes so that we see in more than black and white? Why do we have food that is available that is more than oatmeal? You know, he could have made it so that, you know, oatmeal has every nutrient we have and that's all we need. There it is, you know, run with it. And yet we have spices and we have fruit and, you know, so many things that are just full of different flavors. And, you know, if you walk through the produce section of your grocery store, you ought to be astounded at what God provides for us. That it isn't basic. God is not stingy, and nor is he prudish in this sense, right, of just trying to do the minimalist. The minimalist approach to what we need. He's effusive. Here's color upon color upon color. Here's creature upon creature upon creature. You know, some of them don't serve much purpose. It's like, what does a toucan do? Except, you know, be beautiful.
Markets Fruit Loops.
Yeah. He's a cereal provider.
Yeah.
And food upon food upon food, flavor upon flavor. And so it's just, there is this dynamic to creation where God does more than he has to do. And we should realize that really ought to, I mean, that's not to, I mean, I understand why we are wise with our resources and don't go crazy on everything. That's not what I'm after, but, it also seems like God didn't build the world to be as austere as possible. And so that ought to shape how we think about the world as well.
Surely. And we're called to be stewards of creation. That's a theme I've thought about a lot and have some little side projects on that. I taught a course on that for our church's Sunday school. So I don't know if any of that will see the light of day, but It's an important theme, and certainly everything that God has created, he's created it and given it to us for our care, that we would be faithful with it, that we'd be fruitful and multiply, but also that we would develop this world and do so for his glory. All of this presupposes this relationship that we have with the Lord. And that brings us back really to kind of the central theme of righteous by design, covenantal merit, and Adam's original integrity, as well as a theme that we love here at Reform Forum so dearly, what Voss would call the deeper Protestant conception of the image of God in differentiation from a Roman Catholic view. But what Voss was getting at is the basic, it's really the same core message that eschatology precedes soteriology. Mm-hmm. That when God created Adam and placed him in the garden, he created him with an original righteousness and an orderliness where he was directed towards. He's in positive religious fellowship with the Lord as created. It's partly part of how he was made. And then he also is directed towards an even higher state or mode of existence, of life, that he could attain through the covenant that God mm-hmm. established. By his own free will, and by, we could say, by his grace, although that's another question we'll get into. It's, I agree with you very much so that it's probably just best not to talk about grace because it confuses people. Talking about grace mm-hmm. in the Reformed context prior to the fall into sin, I'm much more of a Kleinian on that regard. Mm. Grace is demerited favor. But I understand that there's a benevolence. God did not have to establish a covenant of works, praise be to God. So that it's a little bit of a rapprochement between Murray and Klein there that we can acknowledge those things. But here, back to the main point, this orderliness. I'm wondering if you might unpack a little bit as we begin this major theme of original righteousness. And you argue that Adam was created righteous and fully capable of fulfilling the covenant of works without the need for added grace, or as you mentioned, the donum super additum. Might you express that or speak about that in an introductory fashion as we start to crank up the intellectual heat here in this conversation?
Sure. Yeah. Well, to your point about Voss, I mean, there is a real sense in which my own, you know, understanding of this book is that in his dogmatics, you know, Voss tackles this within like 4 pages.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet it's huge. It's a huge topic mm-hmm. when you actually get into the details of how to work this out. And, you know, I kind of see this as hashing out, elaborating, you know, putting historical mm-hmm. and more extensive exegetical footing to some of Voss's claims in his dogmatics. And so that's, you know, one of the precedents I see to, I see myself as standing in that same line. How sure. do we get our heads around this? You know, one thing that I would say to people who take on reading this book is, this is actually the hardest thing I've ever written. And in really, I hope it's the hardest thing I ever do write.
That's it.
Yeah, it nearly killed me in one respect. I mean, the day that I sent it off to the editors, my wife said, "I haven't seen you this relaxed in years." I'm like, "I told you that this was hard." And she's like, "Yeah, I just didn't get that you meant it." So it is complicated, and there's lots of moving parts to it. But one of the things that is a baseline component in the discussion is really about, What was Adam supposed to do, and mm-hmm. you know, as a creature? And you know, our confession gets to this in chapter 7. You know, addressing God's covenant with man, and you know, although the creatures, reasonable creatures, owe obedience unto God, you know, that's the starting point. Is like, as his creatures, we have to obey him, and mm-hmm. and we can't. You know, on that sheer premise right there, we can't expect anything to come to us, you know, aside from continuing in good fellowship with the Lord, which is important. And yet there are these suggestions throughout Scripture, you know, catch points at various points of Scripture where it suggests that even from creation, there was a higher state for Adam to achieve, this new creation life. He would have had a deeper experience of communion with God. And, you know, whether you just call that glorification or you call that the beatific vision or what, you know, whatever you want to call that, there is.
Sure. It's both and. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. There is this eschatological mm-hmm. destiny that was held out for Adam. And so the question is, well, how does he get there? How would he have attained it? And there are different answers, you know, that, well, in the Roman system, it's like, well, the creaturely minimum can't attain merit. And so God supplements his nature so that he can perform works of true meritorious value. In the Reformed tradition, you know, the mainstay answer has, rather than ontological elevation of human nature, it's been God's condescension by covenant. And mm-hmm. and that actually is really important, because the way I've grabbed hold of, you know, Westminster 7:1's language of condescension, because it has been suggested that the covenant of works does the same thing as the donum super additum. And I don't think that's correct, because the direction on it is different. The donum super additum elevates human nature, whereas in Reformed theology, covenant is God's condescension. So it's God coming down to the way that he made us. And so rather than needing something supplemental, you know, a different work or more value to the work for Adam to reach his eschatological destiny, my argument is that God covenanted with Adam to accept what he was supposed to do. His natural mm-hmm. obligations became the covenantal obligations that would warrant his entry into glorified life.
Yeah, there's a handful of things to unpack there. This is a really interesting conversation, and it's important that we are very clear on this, because there have been all sorts of different ideas proffered out there, and some less helpful than others, not just even between Reformed and Roman Catholic views, but even among certain Reformed theologians. I think we need to start, number one, there's two questions here. You raised a really important point. What are we supposed to do? Well, we're supposed to offer God our obedience. Mm-hmm. But there's another question here. What are we able to do, even before the fall? And that kind of gets to the point of the difference between the Reformed and Roman Catholic, or I should maybe be even more specific, Calvinistic and Thomistic views on anthropology. And some of these might seem like such a fine point that some people might say, well, what does it even matter? Well, they make a big difference, because there's a lot of things that flow out of these and that flow downstream in our issue. And we can talk about some of those differences. But I think when we're looking at Westminster Confession of Faith 7:1 and speaking about this condescension, no reasonable creatures could never have any fruition of God as their blessedness and reward, but by some voluntary condescension on God's part, which he has been pleased to express to us by way of covenant. That's probably not word for word, but it's my paraphrase, close enough.
That's pretty good.
So when whatever we're saying there, we need to maintain, God is not changing. Okay, number one, this is not a mutable God who is somehow was transcendent and now no longer is transcendent. This also is not speaking of revelation proper. It's speaking of our knowledge of God as blessedness and reward, which mm-hmm. is very different from speaking of knowledge of God simpliciter. Like, we have an inbuilt, concreated knowledge of God by virtue of being made in his image. But there's a distinction. I don't want to introduce a temporal divide between the two, but we need to distinguish between creation and covenant. The standards do, and I think the Bible does. But just as soon as Adam was created and placed in the garden, he established this covenant of works with him. We need to make sure we don't collapse those two, so that creation is covenantal, or that God somehow established these things by creational order. No, this is an act of providence, a special act of providence, is his establishing of the covenant of works. But then we start to get into the question of, okay, how are we to be judged? or Adam prior to the fall into sin? How is he to be judged? And then what is the nature of this merit? Before we get into talking about merit, this is a really hypercharged, supercharged subject, and I really appreciate and love your treatment of it here, but I'm wondering if you might, I want to pause and just give you some time to react, or maybe we can talk more about the nature of man as created and maybe some of those finer points of difference with the Roman Catholic view before we start talking about the nature of merit and how Adam's to be judged.
Yeah, one of the things that is missed in this discussion. So there's a theological component and there's a historical component. And I think that there's a growing consensus in a theological area, but one of the things that can stymie us to a degree is the historical component, because it surprised me as I was doing the research for this how diverse the medieval tradition and it was on some of these questions. And so when we kind of go back and forth about one figure, whoever that may be, I think our focus is too locked in that we don't see how this is a growing discussion. Even, really it picks up with Peter Lombard, in his sentences, and he's asking this question about if there's, you know, a state of pure nature, essentially, or if there's grace to merit, and there's a commentary tradition. I mean, even just one of the parameters I set, at least as a starting point to unpack the historical development, because everybody, academics in the medieval period had to write a commentary on Lombard.
Right. And so it was just part of the path.
Yeah.
Everyone had to know it. Everyone had to write something about it.
And you had to lecture through sentences before you could do your own thing. And so looking at commentaries on Lombard sentences from the Paris universities, because I mean, the biggest figures were in Paris. So that wasn't sort of an arcane sort of thing over in the corner, but the heavy hitters were always ending up in Paris, at least for a time, and tracing how they are doing very different things with some of these questions, and they will even change their minds, and so
unheard of, Harrison.
right, and there's more tension between them. That so you know, as we look at modern Roman Catholic theology, and some of the big books on even this topic, you know, Lawrence Feingold, you've had Dr. Feingold on this program to talk even about related issues here.
It's a great conversation. Yeah.
They are doing historical theology of sorts, but there is also, since the 19th century, a turn where even the history is trying to reconcile theological issues within the history. And I think that we read that from the outside and take essentially that agreement for granted. And one of the things that comes out of the historical chapters, at least I hope comes out, is this is so messy. And even modern Rome follows a certain theological trajectory that began within a more particular corner of theologians. I mean, really, it is a Franciscan development, and pure nature in particular of this idea of kind of the animal nature of humanity disconnected from a supernatural end, destiny. That is at least clearest and most pointed in early Franciscan thought, and then develops in kind of the more emphatically problematic direction as the Franciscan tradition develops, in Scotus, and then thinkers like Gabriel Biel. I mean, so Occam, Biel are kind of really bringing this into its full flowering. And after the Reformation, I mean, post, Cajetan and Bellarmine.
Exactly.
They're not necessarily Franciscans, but the Franciscan paradigm becomes the dominant view. And then mm-hmm. with the Leonine decrees that every Roman Catholic in the 19th century, that every Roman Catholic has to be a Thomistic thinker. Well, whatever the history of Thomas's views, you're going to make your views Thomas's views.
That's the genius of Catholicism. I mean, my guy, not that I appreciate him, but a guy I studied, Karl Rahner, is a great example of that. His whole tradition has been kind of clumsily labeled transcendental Thomism, and that's because they all have to be Thomas.
Yeah.
But they don't want to be, handcuffed to a particular version. They still want to be creative and do their own work. And so, you know, they used Kant and then even more modern philosophy, such as Heidegger in Rahner's case, to kind of reinterpret Thomas and, mm-hmm. and find a freedom. And I found one of the most important things I've found in this book for me, I'm not saying this is something that everyone's going to appreciate, but I appreciated your historical theological treatment very much, because I think so many people in the Reform world might have a picture of Thomas Aquinas, but it really, at the end of the day, might be a caricatured or a simplified view that has been crystallized and advanced by Cajetan and Bellarmine. So yeah. That isn't exactly what Thomas was saying about those issues, or at least it might be one very dogmatic interpretation of Thomas. And to just say that that's what Thomas's view is, well, that's not helpful.
There was a rationalism at work to say, well, this is our view. And of course, I mean, so this is coming from the Roman Catholic perspective, right? I'm just sort of personifying mm-hmm. it. You know, there was a rationalism in saying, well, this is our view. And given that it's true, of course, Thomas Aquinas had to hold the same true view. But he didn't really articulate it the way that we are. And so it had to be the case, and this is where the rationalism kicks in, it had to be the case that these distinctions that we can use to make sense of what he said, he had to presume them. And mm-hmm. I think we can question that, you know, just own it that you're developing a set of ideas. And I think that this is so, you know, one of the things that people may come away from that historical theology is like, well, are you sympathetic? Are you, you know, antagonistic to any of these theologians? Well, you know, proving who was right among the medievals was not exactly my goal. But as one of the things that I think is fruitful coming out of that discussion, as I try to trace this particular topic from the medievals into the modern Roman Catholic tradition, is to show that the idea of kind of a seamless tradition isn't there. And that
you're right,
that it is smooth though. And so the diversity on the historic, you know, pointing out from the historical theological perspective, pointing out the diversity is a pro-Protestant polemic implicitly to say, well, this is not sort of as monolithic as is often suggested in the modern Roman literature. And then one of the other aspects that I also think comes out of this is it shows us how when it comes to doctrines, I don't know that it's the case that we say, well, this guy was helpful, and so as a person, he was helpful. So you really have to look at individual ideas and say, well, who was doing what with these ideas? And there is a sense of what were the other ideas in his own time? And because there are figures treated in this book with whom I don't disagree in full. I mean, I don't agree with them in full. Sorry. You know, I have my disagreements with them. And yet mm-hmm. when I compare them to some other folks in the medieval period, I'm like, well, you know, that's better. that's not to say I like everything that was said, but I see what you were trying to do. And, you know, being Augustinian is a good thing. And in our day and age, we might need a reminder of that, that being Augustinian is a good thing. I've seen some literature recently that seems not to think that being Augustinian is all that great. And then when it comes to the anthropological point, yeah, I think at the confessional level in the Reformed tradition, this affirmation of that by nature we could do what we were supposed to do, that we didn't drift towards doing the wrong thing, but that Adam mm-hmm. was, I mean, humanity, because we're made in the image of God, has this integrity where we could have done what we're supposed to do. I mean, Westminster Confession, chapter 4, paragraph 2, talks about how after God made all the other creatures, he created man, male and female, endued with knowledge, righteousness, and true holiness, after his own image, having the law of God written in their hearts, and power to fulfill it. And power to fulfill it. You know, he could do what he was supposed to do. And I think in the Irish Articles, you see, I mean, this phrase, the strength of nature, was one that appears in the Irish Articles, which I thought was a fascinating way to put it. I think that there's a Reformed idea that Adam, there are other categories related to providence. And of course, God has to enable us. We're not autonomous. We can't do anything apart from the Lord upholding and enabling things. But there wasn't a deficiency in human nature that meant we had to right. do the wrong thing, if not for direct intervention.
Yeah, this is an issue with the traditional Roman Catholic theology, and there's even differences of opinion and how to interpret this within their tradition, but the issue of concupiscence. Mm-hmm. And some of this arises from the very just fundamental way. It comes back to philosophy with this hylomorphism, this form-matter distinction. And if I were to give a maybe simplistic interpretation, it's not the only interpretation that's out there, but you basically have man's natural capacity, his being a material creature and natural, but then you also have his spiritual dimension, his spiritual orderliness. And those two things are, you hope, in aligned with one another, but by nature of what they are, they're not. So the human body and all the natural aspects have an orderliness towards the highest natural good, which could include certain appetites and all of these kinds of things. And then you have this spiritual directedness. So you have this, in traditional Roman Catholic theology, man as created is a little bit out of whack. This is kind of a hard way to put it. And they would be very careful and quick to say, this is not sin. Man is not created in sin, or even necessarily with some sort of essential proclivity to sin, but there is this bent. It's a drift. It's a drift towards self-love. And the way I read it and understand it, it's a miss, because his natural directedness is not necessarily pointed to the same true north as his proper spiritual directedness. And so in Roman Catholic theology, this is fixed, or this is balanced out through the donum superadditum. Mm-hmm. That's lost at the fall into sin. So nothing happens, nothing is damaged according to man's natural capacities, properly speaking, when man falls, but he loses this donum superadditum. And the grace that provided is provided now post-fall through the sacraments. Now that's a 101, pretty basic level of understanding. And again, I don't mean to say that everyone that listens to this is going to agree with that interpretation, but that's kind of a basic overview picture. That's very different from a traditional Reformed view, which would say that no, Adam was created not with this inherent tension or drift away from the Lord, but he was created with in positive religious fellowship, where as created, he was very good. and all of his constitution, all of his parts, so to speak, mm-hmm. are oriented in the right direction. Now, one thing that's important here too is you mentioned in the book that Thomas also held to the fact that Adam was created with an original righteousness. But how might we differentiate that from some other maybe Reformed views that we've understood?
So differentiating Thomas from Reformed views?
Yeah.
So the one of the discussions here, so to sort of back up one step before leading right into that, one of the discussions going on in the period was whether or not Adam was created with that first grace, with original exactly. righteousness or not. And at one point in time, and this becomes a real point of disagreement.
This is the issue of pure nature, right?
Yes.
Is Adam created in pure nature or something else?
Yeah. Did he have the donum super additum and whatever its relationship to original righteousness by creation, you know, at the moment, or was there a temporal gap between when he had that grace and when he was made? And this comes into Voss's concern for the simultaneous occurrence of mm-hmm. that creation, special act of creation and special act of providence. So, mm-hmm. you know, Adam was made, you know, from the dust of the earth, special act of creation by God. And yet our catechism also talks about the special act of providence of covenanting with him. And this gets to why Voss wants to make sure we say, and by the way, those were simultaneous. Even though they're distinct, they're not distanced from one another. Because in Roman Catholic paradigms, some are going to say Adam was created without this original grace, there's different configurations of sanctifying grace, of the donum super additum and original righteousness. But there, the main issue is, did Adam have what he needed to merit the supernatural destiny when God made him? And so like Bonaventure is going to say no. And you know, there was a real time gap, and that becomes even wider as the Franciscan tradition develops. Thomas at one point said no, but he also senses the problem there, and he kind of says, and so as soon as God made him, Adam did it and got it, and then it was fine. Later he changes his mind from his sentence commentary to later writings and says God made Adam with this original righteousness, you know, it was concreated in a temporal sense. It was still superadded in a logical sense, but there wasn't the temporal gap in later Thomas's writing. And the issue that comes out of that is, can you earn first grace? And that's a big one. Can you earn God's first act of grace? And essentially Franciscans are saying, yes, if Adam had acted in accord with what he should have done in pure nature, he would have obtained this supernatural orientation by, you know, purely natural things and then been oriented towards the supernatural, and therefore he earned first grace. And that's why the more Augustinian, now there's still problems, I think, in the hypothetical distinction of the supernatural capacity that Thomas is doing, but you sense how he's trying to lean this more in an Augustinian way. You can't earn first grace. And that's the Dominican position. For that period, at least, you can't earn first grace. And that's what drives so much of this discussion that as it progresses throughout the centuries is later medievals and then Rome leans into, yes, you can earn first grace. And that was one of the real sparks on the powder keg for the Reformation is how essentially, yeah, you can basically handle this because the donum super additum was the super added gift, when it went away with sin, just took us back to normal. We weren't oriented towards our supernatural destiny, but if God gave us back that super attitude, the donum super attitude, we could just be reordered to it. But other than that, we're fine at the natural level and not damaged. But in Reformed theology, Protestant theology, we're asserting, no, sin damaged the baseline. We're not okay, just mm-hmm. from the, without this supernatural orientation. In fact, we were made for that. And so with the things that are wrong with us because of sin now, we're not even at the natural level. We're subpar. Now, I get that Paul will talk about, by nature, but I think that as, things that aren't good come up by nature. But, I mean, I understand that to be according to fallen nature.
Of course. Yeah, we're no longer created in knowledge, original knowledge, righteousness, and holiness.
Right.
But we're darkened in our understanding. Think of, just one great part for this, Romans 1 and 2, or 1 especially, and Ephesians 4 talk about this quite a bit. You're speaking about earning grace or earning some sort of reward. I'm wondering if we could pick up on this and get into some discussion, particularly of ex pacto merit, which is a category I wish more people understood during the Shepherd controversy, because I think it would have, I think it would have avoided some unfortunate results. But your concept, and it's really important. I love Turretin on this especially, but the concept of ex pacto merit is a key part of your book, Righteous by Design. I'm wondering if you can explain this kind of in distinction from congruent and condign merit and why it's important to have this third category for understanding what's happening within the covenant.
So in the Roman paradigm, they have the categories of condign and congruent merit. And condign merit is, it's exact merit. I mean, the work inherently, intrinsically is worth the reward it receives. Mm-hmm. And, all of us probably, if we have a good sense of of the creator-creature distinction, as soon as you say that, when it comes to that relationship, us to God, whether sin is in the picture or not, we ought to be a little bit bashful about, I can just do something and God owes me for it.
Precisely. It's like some order of the universe. It's almost like apart from God's own will. It's like based on the way things are, if I do this thing, it mechanistically deserves this reward.
Right. Right. It has to, and there are different. So that's why the ontological consideration comes in the donum super attitum a lot, is they're saying, well, yes, of course, they're recognizing that same truth to a degree. And I think they're solving it or trying to solve it in a problematic way by saying, well, so we just supplement human ontology so that our works can be supernaturally meritorious in a condign way. Congruent merit is kind of a quasi merit, a half merit. Mm-hmm. It's almost merit. It's things that God has decided to accept as meritorious. And those things can still be tainted with sin, and not perfect in themselves, depending on who's explaining this. And what covenantal merit, ex pacto merit does, as I'm articulating it, is that, and it is in the Reformed, I think we lost track of it in the 20th century, large in part because we were fixated on German sources. This is all over the Latin sources, right?
Sure.
I didn't struggle to find evidence for this category in the Reformed tradition. Ex pacto merit serves as a third thing because It's recognizing that there's no way that as creatures we can just deserve something extra from God. And so we can't ontologically deserve eschatological reward. At the same time, it's also recognizing that God can't accept something deficient as meritorious. Mm. And so it's binding two real concerns together, that God does have to accept, and there has to be a voluntary acceptance on God's part. That's the covenant. But at the same time, it's not that God can just decide to accept anything. It's mm-hmm. that God has decided to accept what we ought to have done, what we ought to have done as meritorious. And that's why it's perfect, personal, and perpetual righteousness, as our catechism puts it.
Sure.
It's not.
That's helpful that, yeah, ex facto merit needs to be aligned and directed toward what is good, what is right, what is noble and true, because it needs to comply with God's own very nature, so to speak. So God is not going to reward sin, for example. But there's also this other dimension that I find helpful when understanding the difference between congruent and condign merit, for example, or congruent and ex facto merit. So condign merit's this kind of just merit-based, you know, as you already mentioned, it's kind of like in the order of creation, the order of the universe. Your act inherently deserves a reward. Congruent merit has been put to me, and I find it very helpful. Is kind of sometimes we can liken it to God grading on a curve. It's like, well, you only got a 65, but you were the best score out of everyone, so we're going to make that 100.
Yep.
And we're going to give you a reward as if you got a perfect score, even though you didn't. So then the question is, now that God has established the covenant of works, how is he grading Adam? How is he measuring Adam's obedience? It needs to be perfect, exact, and entire, perpetual obedience. So what category is that? Is it condign or is it congruent? Because the reward, the whole arrangement is gracious in one use of that word, meaning God didn't, it's yeah, free. God did not have to enter into the covenant of works. He did it of his own free will, of his own accord, out of his benevolence towards his creature. So some people say, well, therefore the covenant of works has to be gracious because God was free to enter into it. He didn't have to. And Adam doesn't twist God's arm, and God is not obligated to give anything to Adam. By nature of Adam's creation, he needs to be obedient, even if he won't receive a reward. Okay, we know that. But then if Adam sins, does God just say, well, you know, I'll give you a free pass on that one. I'm going to grade you on a curve with regard to this covenant. No. Clearly, we see the instant that Adam disobeyed, he receives the full punishment. So God is judging him strictly. So how do we make sense of this? Because it doesn't seem to be condign, nor does it seem to be congruent. That's where this category is so helpful, that the ex facto merit, or merit that arises from within the arrangement of the covenant, is really just saying that God has bound himself by his word to enter into this arrangement and then to reward obedience, which is a good thing and demanded of Adam regardless, but he has chosen of his own free will and out of his benevolence and love toward his creature in condescension to reward obedience with eschatological life. And the terms of that are going to be expressed. Eschatological life for obedience, perfect obedience, and eschatological death for disobedience. And Adam disobeys. So it's so helpful here that we can have a strict merit in the covenant that is not condign and that is not congruent. And that was just so missing, in the Shepherd controversy, but also in a lot of Reformed history.
Yeah, God doesn't lower the standard,
right?
But he accepts what ought to be the case, and mm-hmm. that is one of the you know, this whole discussion is so full of
and neither is he bound. He's only bound to reward Adam because of his own word.
Yeah.
He's not a liar. So he's not bound by some universal principle that if Adam refrains from eating the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God, there's nothing based on that tree or the way that God created where if Adam doesn't eat from it, then all of a sudden he's owed eschatological life. It's because God established that as the radical test of obedience.
Yeah, it's sacramental.
Yeah.
And there's some fascinating discussions. I wish I had I went with Tertullian because he was ancient, but I wish I had actually incorporated some of the Reformed discussions because there's this tradition of seeing the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as encapsulating the moral law. And symbolically, you know, I mean, when Adam ate of that tree, he murdered humanity. He stole fruit that God said belonged, you know, whoever it belonged to. It didn't belong to Adam because God said it didn't. And so
he lusted after it. Coveted. Yeah. Oh, you can go through all the commandments. Absolutely.
And so there's this way that this command sums this up. And yet that isn't baked into that tree, you know, as a tree. And so there is something voluntary about the it's not just fully synonymous with nature and creation as such. There is a covenant creation distinction, and yet they're not entirely different orders. And I think that's where we get our difference from the Roman system is that the natural and supernatural orders are part and parcel in how they think. I mean, that, and I'm not inferring that. I mean, Lawrence Feingold will tell you this is a first premise of the Roman paradigm is the natural supernatural orders. And so I think we, in some ways, sidestep the need to be ordered to something else because God orients us to supernatural life by the covenant, by meeting us as we are, rather than raising us to something else.
Yeah. No, that's really good, Harrison. I'm wondering if we could, this has been fascinating. Obviously, this is a deep dive and we got to get into, people need to read this book. And we can have multiple episodes coming out of this to talk about some of these finer points in greater detail down the road. And I'd like to do that. But I would like to maybe provide some more practical points. Not that this isn't practical, because this has to do with who we are and what our eternal destiny is. Before we close up today, because we're a little bit over our normal time, I got nowhere to be, but I want to respect your time as well, but and our listeners as well. You also highlight, we've been speaking about humanity's relationship to God. We could call that a vertical relationship. And God has designed us for that vertical communion with himself. But there's more than that too. We can also think about our relationship to other humans as well. There's a horizontal dimension to who we are and how we are to live and how we are to relate. I'm wondering if you might speak to that and speak about how the gospel in particular, after Adam's fall into sin and how we all were we fell in him and with him in his first transgression, how the gospel not only restores our relationship with the Lord, but also, in a sense, restores our proper relation to one another in the church specifically.
Yeah. So, you know, when God created man, when he created humanity, one of the things in that description, that account that we have in Genesis 1 is right on the tail end of creating us, there's this assignment, you know, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. There is this, just coming out of existing, we have a relationship to all the things going on around us. And when God made us, that was supposed to be good and it was supposed to stay good, you know, by intention. And sin has messed that up. And so the covenant community was bound together. And now at that point, it was only two people. But still, the covenant community was bound together because they are bound in a covenant. And so that was supposed to be a spreading of good things, right? Even in the state of perfection, good things were supposed to expand to fill the earth.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And in the new covenant, that's the case again.
You see that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, we can't turn the earth into the new creation, you know, by our strength anymore, because sin has corrupted it. Like we can't get back to neutral. And I don't mean that in a anti-Vantil sense. I mean, in terms of, you know, at creation, there wasn't sin.
Yeah. Yet. We don't hit a reset button and start over.
Right.
Even the gospel doesn't ultimately bring us back to Eden. It brings us to where Eden pointed toward, the new heavens and the new earth.
But the
mode that we get there is not a, you know, earthly transformationalist mode.
Right. That's right. And so
it's a social gospel, really.
One of the beautiful things that I think comes out of this structure of the covenant of works is that Christ, as the second Adam, has merited everlasting life, glorified existence for all his people.
Amen.
Yeah. And that is... It cannot be undone. He's done it. It's not contingent. It's not conditioned upon anything we achieve. One of the effects of receiving that blessing is that we're not only tied to him, but tied to one another. You know, you can't love the head of the body without loving the body itself. Mm-hmm. To draw on Paul's metaphor, I'm preaching through John's epistles, and I'm starting 2 John this coming Sunday. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me in John, I'm convinced, you know, and this is not unique to me, it's in the literature, that 2 John was probably the cover letter with the introduction and greetings for 1 John. But one of the things that John says as he's opening this greeting is that, you know, he does the in some ways cryptic, people are trying to make sense of it, address to the elder, to the elect lady and her children. I think that's the church and its members, and that's not unique to me. And then he describes the church and its members, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth. And then he states, because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. And to put that in a different language, he says, I love you not because of something about you, but because the Lord Jesus Christ is in you. He loves the covenant community, not because things inherently lovable, but because the Lord Jesus Christ binds us together. And so how does all of this affect the horizontal relationship? Well, Jesus Christ has earned our everlasting destiny for everyone who trusts in him, and he is at work in us now. And one of the things that he is doing is that apart from what is good about us in ourselves, Jesus is the reason for loving one another. You know, I know that that person is not only made in the image of God, but is remade in the image of God and loves the same Savior whom I love and is loved by the same Savior who loves me. And so, first reason why I love the other members in the church where, you know, I'm a member is because of the Lord Jesus Christ. And because he is the thing that, he is the person who ties us together, and he is going to tie us together forever. And so we might as well get used to loving each other now, because that's going to be the case in everlasting life.
Yeah, I love how this brings us back to the eschatological dimension to this, and how the Bible so often speaks, and Paul especially speaks about Christ as the first fruits of the harvest. in his resurrection, he's the first of many, which is all of God's people will be raised imperishable. He's also the down payment, the Holy Spirit specifically, but he's the guarantee of this greater harvest to come. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand that we are part of this, and that's our guaranteed future, is to be present with the Lord. But it's not just one of us; it's all who have been called by the Lord,
all
and whose
us.
Names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life, will be present with Him in the new heavens and the new earth. That's what we were made for, to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. So I'm very thankful for that. For Harrison, I think we only scratched the surface. We'll have to do a round two. Yeah. And talk some more about this medieval theology, but I love it, and really appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to spend time with you, and I am thankful for your appreciative review and even just time talking about the book.
Yeah, brother. Well, take a look at New Horizons. I think maybe the May, I don't know what's the current issue, but the May or the June issue will have my little review in there. But in the meantime, and even beyond that, pick up copies of these books. We have Righteous by Design, Covenantal Merit and Adam's Original Integrity, published by Mentor, and then Created for Communion with God, The Promise of Genesis 1 and 2, that's published by Lexham Press, and both are written by our guest today, Dr. Harrison Perkins. This has been really fun, Harrison. I'll point people to the books and the appropriate places online, and point people also to our website at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our upcoming events, courses, publications. And I do want to mention that registration for our annual theology conference is open. Come visit us September 27th in Gurnee, Illinois, nearby here, the office. We're going to be in a much bigger facility, a bigger venue this year. So we're hoping and doing our best to double our attendance. We've got 5 speakers coming. All the Reformed Forum faculty, myself, Lane Tipton, Carlton Wynn, Jim Cassidy, and then also we are adding this year Dan Ragusa, one of our dear friends. He's going to be speaking as well, and we're going to be diving into seeing Christ in all of Scripture from Luke 24. This is going to be a big event. We'd love to have everyone here. Take a look at our website, reformedforum.org/conference, for information and registration. A lot of fun lined up there. We'll have to get you around the lake. I don't know. I don't have a custom shuttle or a ferry boat to get you over here, Harrison.
That would be
maybe
great.
Somebody can ride in and we can get you like your own custom private jet to fly you over for this.
There you go. I'd love to be there.
Or we could get a delegation.
The PCA has a lake party down in Mississippi. We need a lake party too.
I think so. I just got back from that. We need to have the Lake Michigan party.
Yeah.
The big lake. That's great. Well, maybe a bit like the Council of Dort. We'll certainly leave some seats open for you. I just hope you're not like the French and just leave them vacant.
Show up. Thanks.
If your governor won't let you come or whatever.
Yeah.
But we'll have all the Michigan people come. So it's been great. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for watching, for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.